The Health and Human Service Policy Committee will now come to order. Good morning, everyone. First bill before us is House File 2970, Representative Bradley's bill. Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move that House File 2970 be recommended pass and be referred to the Health and Human Services Finance Committee.
That motion is before us. Please tell us about the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is comes to us from the Minnesota Department of Health. States are bound to, or if they don't, then it will be done to us by the federal government to make policy set for the handling of nuclear material. This is material that would be used in medical, educational, those kind of settings. And what this is proposing to do is to allow us to describe how we want to have those regulations established. If we don't, and as I said, in a timeline, then the National Regulatory Commission would come to us and tell us what we do. So you'll see that part, one of part is just establishing, allowing us to do the regulation, which will be passed, and then the responsibility to the state ultimately. And then the other part, partly as a consequence of the way we intend to do it, you actually will see kind of an unusual thing, and that is a reduction in the fees, the first-time fees and the annual fees in this field. I think with that, Madam Chair, I would turn over for the Department of Health to sort of take us through what the bill actually does.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Linda Brummer. I'm section manager of asbestos, indoor air, lead, and radiation in the Environmental Health Division at the Department of Health. And what this bill does, we were first authorized to pursue this agreement state status with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in 1999. So we've been back in front of you several times working on this. This is not new. What it is we're finally working on the finishing pieces of the package for our application to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. The reasons for what is in this bill today are we are actually lowering the fees that we brought to you, I believe, 2 years ago. We had come up with a formula that was confusing for everyone, and we looked at it. We had also said that we needed 5 full-time equivalents to run this program. We've relooked at those numbers. We've decided to cross-train our X-ray inspectors, so we've lowered the numbers. We've gone to what these fees are that you see in this bill are a standard. It's 80% of what these groups are already paying the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. So it's a reduction in the cost to the regulated community. They already pay the higher fee to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. So that's what basically it's our new set of fees. And then the last piece, the agreement state application and rules, you have put in statute that we have to come back to you we have at several stages to ask permission to continue to pursue this application. And I guess that's the other piece of this we're requesting, that you approve the work that we've done so far. Basically where we are, as you can see, we're finalizing the fees. We have a rule that we've been negotiating, we've been working on with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. They're happy. We're about ready to go to hearing, or not to hearing, notice on the rule. The rule, again, is we had written it previously. If you heard of people being upset about this program, it was partly because we tried to do more than what was reasonable, and now we've gone to a parallel rule to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. I've spoken with, basically, this is 160 licensees in the state, and the areas that are regulated are primarily academics, as Representative Bradley said, industrial uses, and medical uses. And with that, I'll wait and see if you have questions.
Are there any questions for Ms. Brummer? Is there anyone from the audience that wishes to testify on this bill? I don't see anyone. Representative Paymar.
Madam Chair, I didn't know if my constituent was going to come today, but I have a professor who lives in my district, former professor who taught at McAllister, you know about that?
Madam Chair, Representative Paymar, I know Dr. Woolsey quite well.
Yeah.
He worked. Do you want me to explain the story?
Yeah, why don't you? Because I think he has a different slant on this, and I have to admit, I don't know what the truth is, but he does not think that this is necessary and believes that the government is doing an adequate job doing this, and it's not saving the state any money. And but maybe you probably know this better.
Well, Ms. Bremer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In my conversations with Dr. Woolsey, he's the former chair of chemistry at McAllister College. And one of the things we are doing is you will see there is a fee for $300 for nonprofit academic institutions in our list of fees. There was a $1,000 fee in the list that we're deleting. Dr. Woolsey feels that they don't currently pay a fee to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for their use of radioactive materials. By the state taking over the program, we are asking the small colleges to pay a $300 fee to have nuclear materials, and that's the basic disagreement that we have. We have met with small nonprofits. We met with Carleton College and I believe St. John's, and they say, well, it's not that big a cost, and the regulatory perspective on this is, we feel it's important for academic institutions, particularly small ones, to keep track of their radioactive materials. And really, if they have to pay a fee, an annual fee, to keep track of that material, I guess that ensures that they analyze whether or not they continue to need that material on site. Dr. Woolsey would say, well, but you're drying up the pipeline of students, you're going to get us out of the business of dealing with radioactive materials and doing research in them. That's not the intent, but that's the gist of Dr. Woolsey's and my disagreement on it.
Representative Paymar.
But I also thought one of his issues was is that the federal government is currently doing all of this and will continue to do it, so why should the state get in the business of doing it?
Ms. Bremer.
Madam Chair, Representative Paymar, It's a matter of proximity. We had an example. Right now, my inspectors, as they're being trained in and taking a rigorous classwork that the federal government requires us to take, we've gone out on inspections with the federal inspectors, and quite frankly, I think we can do a better job because we're closer. They come in, the closest regional office is Lisle, Illinois, outside Chicago. We had a case in Alexandria where there was a call about misuse of some material. The inspector flew in, drove up to Alexandria. My inspector went along with her. She had to leave at a certain point in time because she had to get back to get her plane back to Chicago. And my inspector certainly could stay around longer than that's a specific example of, I hope you get the idea of, I feel by being in the state, we can do a better job of regulating these things.
Okay. Representative Paymar.
Is this costing the state, will this cost the state more money?
Ms. Paymar.
Madam Chair, Representative Paymar, no.
Any further discussion, members? Seeing none, Representative Bradley, do you have any further comments?
Well, Madam Chair, the only thing I think I would add, I believe this is about the 34th state or something like that to ratify this, so it's pretty good precedent.
Okay. Seeing no further discussion or comments, Representative Bradley renews his motion that House File 2970 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Representative Bradley, stay where you are. House File 2581. Representative Bradley.
Madam Chair, I move that House File 2581 be recommended to pass. And, I'm going to suggest the floor. I haven't gotten a fiscal note. I don't think there's enough to warrant, but if the department has any advice on that as we move along, I would appreciate it. So at this point, I would suggest that we recommend it to the general register.
Okay, the motion's before us. Representative Bradley, explain the bill, please. have an amendment, I see.
Madam Chair and members, yes, we do have an amendment. So let me get that, because that brings the bill into the form that I would discuss with the committee. So I would move amendment
DE2. Representative Bradley moves the DE2 delete all amendment. All those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This came to me as a result of United Way and I suppose other charities too, who were worried as we were approaching the federal government in our attempts to sort of close some loopholes, do the right thing as far as I'm concerned in the potential transfer of assets that people do and then leave, in a sense, the taxpayer for the bill and nursing home particularly. What I think the United Way brought to my attention is something that you don't think about, and that is the chilling effect that this could have on people who want to make donations to charitable organizations. And it felt that at the 3 years that we currently are, that it's containable, but that if it did in fact successfully move to 6 years, that it would have a chilling effect. So what this does is provides exclusionary language for the charitable donations with some discretion on the part of the commissioner. Maybe to give a little bit more background, that's basically what the bill does. It provides, if you look at the language, it's fairly straightforward, that it exempts transfers made for a charitable cause with some conditions on it to be sure that, in fact, it's clearly is a charitable donation, that there's a pattern given, and give some discretion to the commissioner to affirm that. But I think, in fairness, I don't think any of us were trying to chill the effect of being able to give, especially to United Ways and other charities. So with that, I'd like to introduce a representative of United Way who might give just a little more background.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, thank you. Members of the committee, my name is Byron Lair. I'm an employee of the United Way in the Twin Cities, and I'm here at the request of the 49 different United Ways serving in Minnesota. As Representative Bradley stated, this bill addresses what was an unintended consequence of last year's decision to pursue a six-year look back for individuals qualifying for long-term care assistance from the state. We heard from United Way volunteers, representatives from foundations and other charities, from estate planners and tax attorneys, that a six-year look back would cause them to begin discouraging charitable contributions, something that none of us found desirable. The language in this bill clarifies ways in which an individual could meet his or her burden of proof to show that a charitable contribution made before that individual qualified for long-term care assistance was in fact charitable and not simply an attempt to create artificial poverty. We urge your support for this bill. Thank you.
Are there any questions for Mr. Lair? Representative Bradley. Is there any discussion? Representative Otremba.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Representative Bradley, you're saying that there's absolutely no savings at all to cost savings to this bill?
Representative Bradley.
Madam Chair, in my initial conversations, it's not, I don't think, a matter of savings or cost. If it was going to be anything, Representative Tremba, it theoretically could be cost. But I think if you think logically through this, I mean, we're talking about something that is, if we get a federal waiver, which we don't have at this point, and we typically don't fiscal note those kind of things because of the uncertainty of its nature. Plus, I mean, I don't think we're talking about very much of this kind of transaction if you look at how carefully it is defined. So I'm of the mind as a finance chair to say that I don't think that we're going to see anything in terms of fiscal move. But if there were any risk at all, it would be sort of the other way. That is, that we might have something a little less, because those dollars that are given this kind of way would then not be eligible for any recovery of expenses for medical assistance.
Is there anyone from the audience that wishes to testify on this bill? Okay, seeing none. Representative Otremba.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Last year when we did this bill, we didn't have the waiver yet, and we took a savings of $400,000.
Representative Otremba, are you referring to the lien bill? Okay. Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's entirely different, because many of those actions took place right away. We did not claim savings on the look-back. We claim savings on the life estate liens, partnership liens, those things, and those did go into effect right away.
Any further discussion, questions, members?
Okay, I have an amendment.
Representative Otremba, I don't see one, but... Representative Otremba, explain your amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Basically, what it does is repeals what we did as far as life estates and joint tenancy.
So, Representative Otremba, are you saying this repeals all of the action that was taken last session?
In regards to life estate and joint tenancy, and then doesn't allow us to take, because right now we're taking Meals on Wheels, alternative care also, and putting them into liens. So it does all of that we did last year.
Okay, so Representative Otremba, obviously there's a cost to this amendment.
Well, yes, Madam Chair, according to last year's fiscal note, it's $400,000. And as of right now, I don't know of anybody that, I mean, everybody's in court over this. And so I'm not sure we're going to recapture anything, but that's for the courts to decide.
Representative Otremba moves the A1 amendment. Is there a discussion? Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would very strongly oppose this amendment. I guess if your philosophy is that people with means ought to be able to pass the burden of expenses for their nursing home care onto the taxpayer, then you vote for this amendment. If you believe that people who have means, who have assets, should be responsible for their bills, then you would defeat this amendment. Simple as that. I mean, this is wholesale, get rid of the whole thing. The fact that the fiscal note is relatively small is an indication of really some of the misconceptions that are out there. I know there's been a lot of things said about we're taking away people's farms, we're putting liens on the whole things. If you understand the way life estates work, and we have an attorney from DHS who could certainly respond to that, but we're really putting that on the life estate, and the life estate value depends on what the life estate agreement is, but it also changes with the age of the person. And by the way, if you look at the history of the settlements and you talk to people who've been involved in the settlements already that have been done, what you find is that almost all those cases are amicable. There may be a few exceptions. There always are. That's true. But most of those are very amicable. And we do not take away the farm. What we do is we allow for, it's not until there's a sale. There's all kinds of arrangements done to accommodate the family's interests. I think that is done in the right kind of way, and it's the right balance. But certainly to repeal the entire thing to me is exactly the opposite of what we have been trying to do when we've been trying to reach a point of affordability for long-term care expenses to make sure that people who have means, who have estates and have other kinds of means ought to be accountable for their expenses. And this one just flies in the face of that. So I would hope that members would defeat this amendment.
Representative Dempsey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Bradley, you know, I'm always looking for solutions that solve problems rather than just spending money, okay? I'm also on the tax committee, and we have several pieces of legislation that relate to giving people an incentive to buy long-term care insurance. Would long-term care insurance cover the situation that involves this particular amendment?
Madam Chair, Representative Dempsey, that's really an excellent point. The purpose of this was not just to have sort of a punitive side. The purpose really was to try to be positive. Unfortunately, let me put it this way. We insure our homes for possible loss. We insure our lives for possible loss. We insure our car for possible loss. But for some reason, historically, in the case of long-term care expenses, we don't insure. Now, long-term care is one tool that might be able to be used. If we have assets to protect, I mean, for people who don't have assets to protect, yeah, it's really not an issue. But if they do, it seems to me one of the tools that would avoid this kind of thing is the possibility of long-term care insurance. I would also point out, however, that if what you're wanting to do is to protect an asset, I mean, if you have something that you want to be able to pass on and you want to make sure there are no liabilities or liens against it, you might also, because remember, this only occurs, the lien only becomes active after the death and then the subsequent sale of the property, you might even use a tool like life insurance. I mean, it could very well be life insurance. I mean, this really, these kinds of things that we're trying to do here are really to encourage people to do what is morally right anyway. When families do exactly what you're saying, where they sit down with an estate planner and say, you know what, I want to protect my assets. I want to pass it on to my kids. How can I do that? And there are various tools. Long-term care insurance is one of those.
And Madam Chair.
Representative Dempsey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, the thing is sometimes I think we always look to government for, you know, if we spend more money, well, then this will solve the problem, and then we keep continually spending more and more and more money because it doesn't solve the problem. And I think I would like to have, and I don't know how we get out the information, to be quite frank with you, but Representative Otremba, I would say that long-term care insurance, the sooner you take it out, you know, you have homeowners insurance and all the rest of that, that really does have a positive effect. I know I, as one individual, I took out long-term care insurance, and I'll tell you the rate is high for a person my age, I'll tell you that. But I don't think the state of Minnesota has any responsibility for paying for my bills when I go to a nursing home, any more than I expect them to pay for my car insurance, for my homeowner's insurance. Whose responsibility is when you get old? It's yours, in the state. So I'm starting to preach, and I don't want to do that. But I think if I'm correct, that we're saying that this is going to cost the state an extra $400,000, and that's not much out of billions. But I think we've got to start encouraging people to take responsibilities on their own. And long-term care insurance would be one of those, and we're working on that in the tax committee. So I don't see a need for this piece of legislation.
Representative Otremba.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, these life estate and joint tenancies were done, in the early 70s for this very reason. Long-term care wasn't available, and so they were looking at a way that they could pass on their farm or their small business. These are deals that they made with lawyers. Were what you did at that point, so you were able to pass on your farm or your small business. So those are the people that are being affected. People who thought they did the right thing legally, they were the people who paid taxes in the community, they were their asset to the community. Many of them took care of their parents in their homes for 20, 30 years and kept their life estate so that they could retain homestead, and now are getting liens put on their farms when their mother dies or whatever. I mean, they saved the state hundreds of thousands of dollars. If you've taken care of your mother for 30 years, imagine what that saved the government. This was what we did back in the early 70s. I agree that long-term care insurance is the way to go right now for some people. But there are still a lot of people out there who absolutely can't afford or can't even get when they try to get long-term care insurance. They all their life, they did the right thing. They were not trying to hide anything. This was what the law said they could do in the 70s, 80s, 90s. And now we're going back and undoing laws that are 30 years old. It would be one thing if we went forward and did this. But we're going back and undoing things that these people thought was the right thing, paid lawyers, etc. That's the problem. And we have people, there are court cases. And right now in my own county, they're in front of court because they're selling the farm. Every time, if you sell the farm or your house or your business, that's when it happens. But you also retain a lien on your farm the entire time. And so financial institutions are getting very concerned about even giving out loans, or because the state gets the first lien, and then the financial institution gets the second lien. And they're very, very concerned about this, because these were legal transactions that were done. I don't, you know, going forward is another argument, but backdating a law, I mean, I have somebody that it was the late 60s when they did this. And now, fourth generation, they have a lien because their great-grandma died on their farm. That's the problem. And it sets, a precedence for backdating that is unconscionable, actually. And I don't know what else to say and do about this, because backdating laws are going back and undoing laws when we thought we were doing the right thing. And I've looked at it for myself, and you've heard my story. Ken and I worked hard. We paid off our farm. We've done everything right. I have, you know, the $1 million policy for health insurance. I have long-term care insurance. I have a minor child. If I'm in an accident, it doesn't take long to take care of that $1 million. And it doesn't take long for me to use up my long-term care, because, quite frankly, the max I can see getting even in long-term care is 4 years. And that's not a very long time if you get Alzheimer's. So then they would take everything, and my daughter would go on welfare. And then you as a state would be taking care of her, when, even though I thought I was prepared in all of the right ways. Maybe I'm still responsible, but I also, in my faith, believe that there is a place where we have to take care of others also when they've done all the right things.
Representative Soderstrom.
I was just going to ask if it makes a difference if you give your children the property rather than retain this life estate.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, it does. That is, if you actually deed over or give gifts to, you are allowed to do up to, I believe the tax law allow you to do $10,000 without any consequences. If it's more than that, then is when the look back kicks in. So if the transaction was done more than 3 years ago, then the state has no rights to it. Separate, different thing entirely. Yeah.
Any further discussion?
Just one more thing. You know, back in the early, thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, back in the early 70s, I don't have the exact date, we actually sat down with the federal government and tried to figure out what to do. What could we do? Because what the Depression had come, and everybody was losing their farms, and so the Fed said, okay, this is the deal. We won't put a lien against your farm with medical assistance if you do life estates or joint tenancy. That was the agreement that we had with the federal government. So we not only had an agreement that was what we could do, we went through the legal process and did it. And now in 2003, we're going back and undoing all the things that we had agreed and thought were okay. And I'm going to ask for a roll call vote.
Seeing no further discussion, Representative Otremba is requesting a roll call vote on the E1 amendment. And as soon as our committee assistants are ready. Representative Bradley, did you have a further comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just briefly, first of all, when you look through, as we have in detail, month by month, the kinds of ways we see value being protected and used, life estates are the primary means. And I think it doesn't take very long when you look at the amounts of capital people are sitting on, which oftentimes is in the range of $1 million, to see that whatever might have been a good idea is really being abused and the responsibilities are being passed. On the notion of whether or not things change, it happens in tax law all the time. I mean, I know I was a product of a time when limited partnerships were very popular, and you could get in without really having anything, and the law was changed, and I was caught in the middle of that. And, you know, and when I examine it in retrospect, it was probably fair that it changed, and I was sort of caught with something that wasn't worth anything anymore, and frankly, I was getting tax benefits out of it that I shouldn't have been getting. So it is not uncommon to see those kinds of things happen. And the other thing I would point out is, I think I indicated before, it isn't only about using, if you're trying to protect, it isn't only about using long-term care insurance, it's also about using such things as life insurance. Because if all you want to have is some cash available to pay off a potential lien, there's lots of things you can use. So even in the short term, even if long-term care insurance isn't it, a family could sit down, if you've got a life estate situation right today, and very quickly write out. Now, it might cost something, but if there's enough value in it to protect, there are different kinds of tools available.
Well, and members, if I'm assuming most members realize the demographics that we're facing in the next decade or two, and certainly it's the state's resources are going to be insufficient to provide long-term care to all of the numbers of people and the baby boomers and such, so we have to make some choices. Representative Bradley.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, I forgot one other technical detail. Actually, what we're doing here is exercising a right that the federal government has given us since 1993. It's not like it's a brand new all the thing. The federal government has authorized states to do this since 1993.
I understand that, Representative Bradley, but we still have to make some decisions. We have to serve those people that are unable to help themselves, and those that are able to help themselves, they must take the responsibility to do so. Committee assistant.
Boudreaux.
No.
Abler. Bradley.
No.
Dempsey.
No.
Finstead.
No.
Huntley.
Yes.
Norness.
No.
Opatz.
Yes.
Otremba.
Yes.
Tamar.
Yes.
Howell.
No.
Samuelson.
No.
Smith. Soderstrom.
No.
Tao.
Yes.
Walker.
Yes.
Wilkin.
No.
The vote being 6 in support and 9 opposed, the amendment does not prevail and is not adopted. To the DE2, delete all amendments. Representative Bradley, is there any further discussion? Representative Bradley.
Madam Chair, only a sort of a question to the committee. I think we're back to a very non-controversial bill at this point, and I would ask again the will of the committee. It seems like this might be consent calendar material. And if there's a will, I would modify my motion.
Is there any objection to that? Don't see any objection, and so the Representative Bradley modifies his motion that House File 2581 be recommended to pass, be referred to the consent
Chair,
calendar.
I object to having it going on the consent calendar.
Okay, the motion is before us. Okay. Representative Bradley, you want to modify?
Chair, If I remember sort of custom and usage, I think consent calendar requires a full consent, and we've had somebody object. I respect that, so let's go to the General Register.
So Representative Bradley modifies his motion again to send it to the General Register. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails.
Thank you.
Chairman.
Representative Boudreaux, welcome to your committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would first of all move House File 2709 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. And I have an amendment. It is the DE1 amendment, Mr. Chairman. And I would ask that the committee adopt the amendment to put the bill in its desired form.
Representative Boudreaux offers the DE1 amendment. Any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Amendment passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to have some folks representing the optometrists discuss and explain this bill to the committee.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the tape.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Jim Meffert, and I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Optometric Association. This legislation is a result of discussions that have gone on with the Department of Human Services since early last fall.
It's not designed to add any new benefits to the Minnesota Care Limited benefit program, and actually does clarify, puts language that does clarify some of the services that are included in the program. As I said, this language is based on conversations with the department, with health plans, and with our member optometrists around the state. Currently, under the Minnesota Care Limited Benefit Program, eye care services are covered, but they are not covered by optometrists. You have in front of you some letters that indicate the extent of problems that have been created by this, particularly continuity of care with patients who have been on Minnesota Care in the past, have conditions such as glaucoma, or our diabetic patients have gone to an optometrist in rural areas, as those letters will note. And now are not able to go back to that optometrist to receive care, and in some cases will be are being required to drive extensive miles to receive the care that they need. This has also compromised the efficient delivery of acute care for in the same situations. A patient who has an eye infection may have a small superficial foreign body in their eye. Typically would go in many locations around the state, would go to their optometrist to have that taken care of. This creates a problem for that and a potential barrier. And as those letters indicate, and I've been hearing from around the state, those patients may in fact need to go to emergency rooms to receive care that is covered instead of going to their optometrist's office. This is also putting the optometrists in the position of having patients, their longtime patients, coming into their office with these problems, knowing full well that they won't get paid for these services, and right now many of them are doing this gratis. If this doesn't change, the comments that have come back to me are that the optometrists need to reevaluate whether they'll be able to continue that long term. This also has been disruptive in some delivery systems where optometrists and ophthalmologists work together in tandem. In one example in particular in Representative Boudreau's district, an optometrist and ophthalmologist who work in the same office, a patient comes in. If the optometrist is there and the ophthalmologist is in surgery, that would not be considered a covered service if the optometrist saw that patient, even though that's typically how they would handle any patient coming in that situation. We also have about a third of the optometrists in the state, particularly in rural areas, that are on have hospital privileges and are on emergency room call to consult with emergency room patients that come in with eye patients that come in, and this compromises that the ability for the optometrist to actually see those patients and to get paid for them, and for the hospitals to actually get reimbursed for those services. That's a little background on what's happening right now with this program. Let me reiterate that this language does not add any benefits to the Minnesota Limited Benefit Program. The language is designed to improve the delivery of benefits covered by benefits that are covered by the program today.
And Mr. Chairman, we're looking at the potential of whether or not there's a fiscal note, so that's the point of referring it to finance at this point.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and members, I strongly support this bill, and it really is foolish. I don't know why there'd be a fiscal note, since they can get the same service by going to an ophthalmologist and it would be paid for. The difference is, particularly in greater Minnesota, as the testifier said, that in many cases, an ophthalmologist is not available. And for relatively, I wouldn't say simple, but if you get something stuck in your eye, you're working, and something pops out of the machine, and it's a small piece, family practice docs don't want to deal with that. And I had a long discussion on this many years ago with a family practice doc, and he said that they did not want to deal with those issues. They're perfectly happy to have those people go to optometrists and have those emergencies taken care of that way. So this bill addresses a very serious problem, what we did last year. I sort of would like to make an amendment to fix a whole lot more than what we did last year, but this is so important that I won't do that. I mean, you can make the same argument, by the way, We don't cover physical therapists, according to what we did last year. We don't cover occupational therapists in terms of mental problems. We told people in this new subset that, go to a physician, go to a psychiatrist, but don't go to a psychologist, don't go to a chemical dependency counselor. And I don't think we saved any money doing that. And we certainly didn't save any money by telling people that don't go to an optometrist, go to an ophthalmologist. That was a really one of the, I don't think we any of us, or not that I voted for it last year, but I don't think this was really intended. And this is, really does address, I think, a very small problem. It shouldn't cost the state any money, and it will do a good service to people in the state that need this emergency kind of treatment.
Representative Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Since the budget was passed last year, I've been getting a lot. I think majority of the calls that I've been receiving are in regards to the copay. Many members or many people have stopped going to their doctors or picking up medication because they don't have the copay. I have a question for you. If someone who comes in with the Minnesota Care Card and they don't have the money for co-pays, are they going to get turned away?
Mr. Meffert?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tao, the policy right now, I believe, is that they cannot be turned away. And I know in talking to our members, they've had similar situations where patients have been unable to pay co-pays, in particular with the MA program. They have not been turned away. The assumption is that with some of the smaller copays, particularly on the MA program, which this doesn't affect, that they have simply taken that as a loss, but continue to see those patients.
Mr. Chun, do you have a comment here?
Mr. Chair and committee members, I should also clarify that the language we passed for the Minnesota Care co-payment and also the MA co-payment, it did include a provision. It does state that a provider cannot deny services for a person because they can't pay the co-pay, but there's also a provision that says that if it's the routine business practice of a provider to refuse services to persons with uncollected debt, they could then treat a co-payment as uncollected debt. So I think it depends on how the provider wants to apply that provision.
Representative Tao. Committee members, any further questions for Mr. Meffert or Representative Boudreaux?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure if there's anyone in the audience that has a desire to weigh in on this.
Anyone in the audience wish to testify on this? Seeing none, any further questions?
Mr. Chairman, I would renew my motion that House Bill 2709 be recommended to pass, be referred to the Health Human Service Finance Committee.
Representative Boudreaux has renewed her motion that House File 2709 be, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Health and Human Service Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion passes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is Representative Fuller here? Oh, Representative Fuller, have a seat at the table. Welcome to the committee. We're ready to look at House File 2473.
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members.
Good morning. Representative Fuller, could you tell me where the bill that we'll be discussing would be directed?
Madam Chair, at this point, I would say either to the Health and Human Services Finance Committee.
Okay. Yeah. I would move then that House File 2473 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Health Human Service Finance Committee. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and committee members. This bill came to me actually from one of my counties in my legislative district, District 4A, Beltrami County, dealing with child care and absent days. I think this is an issue the committee is familiar with. And I have with me today Megan Mose, who is going to help me explain the bill. There is an amendment, Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Bradley moves the DE2 amendment to delete all amendment to the bill. All those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails.
Just briefly on the amendment, Madam Chair, it changed the number of days. My county actually brought forward the idea of 6 absent days. In some discussion with the county associations, we thought there was a better way to move forward that would be a bit of a compromise, and that's where the DE2 came from, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Foley, why don't you tell us exactly what the days you're talking about and what's the issue? Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Megan Mose, and I'm with MACSA, the County Social Service Directors Association. And we've been very pleased to work with Representative Fuller on this issue. And actually, the DE2 amendment really does represent the statewide position, or 90% at least of the statewide position, our association on this issue. And maybe I can just take a moment to briefly walk through it. And if there are any questions, I'd be happy to respond to those. The changes obviously really start on page 1, line 20, and this is just amending the Child Care Assistance Subsidy section of Statute 119B. And the policy that the DE2 amendment is proposing, of course, is that payment cannot be made for more than 25 absent days, including holidays, per year per child, that there should be no more than 10 consecutive absent days paid per child. And again, this is for all three of the Child Care Assistance Programs, MFIP, Transition Year, and Basic Sliding Fee. And the third piece, of course, states that counties may authorize additional absent days for a child with documented medical needs if the authorization request has been submitted to the Commissioner of Human Services and has been approved by the Commissioner. And maybe just a brief clarification on this piece, Madam Chair. This was not included to cover kids who have colds or sniffles or ear infections. This is really intended to address children that may have ongoing chronic health care needs, the case of leukemia or cystic fibrosis, things that would necessitate them regularly taking additional absent days. There was a desire not to punish kids who may have a need for additional absences and make sure that we have enough slots for children with special medical needs. And then the fourth provision really allows local counties to establish policies with respect to absent days that are more strict, if that is reflective of a local market practice. What we were finding within discussions in our association and in one of Representative Fuller's home counties is that in Greater Minnesota in particular, the market practice with respect to private pay families tends to be a little stricter around absent days, and they did want the flexibility locally to be able to have the subsidy program follow rather than set the local market practice with respect to absent day payments. And I think that pretty much summarizes the DE2.
So Representative Fuller, it essentially gives the counties a little bit of flexibility in how the decisions are made on a case-by-case basis.
Madam Chair, that's my intent.
Is there any discussion or questions for Representative Fuller or Ms. Mose? Representative Towle?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. What if one of the children or child has the cold and didn't want to come but didn't go to the doctor either to get the documented piece of paper there to prove it? What do we do with that?
Ms. Mose, or Representative Fuller?
Madam Chair, Representative Towle, as long as that cold doesn't last for more than 10 days in a row or they don't have 25 colds in a year, I think they'll be okay.
Representative Walker.
Madam Chair, Representative Fuller, to that point, though, two different things. With so many families now, unfortunately, not having adequate insurance and having a flu or whatever and not being able to go to the doctor, it could be possibly 10 days that a child is out, or you have your child out for the first 5 days because he's sick, and then you catch that bug and you're out for the next 5 days. And so neither one of you have the insurance or the money to go to the doctor to take care. And then I think to myself, my son, his first 4 years, he had chronic ear infections. I mean, I was out of school and at home with him more than I'd like to be. He only went a couple months without it, and at 4, finally got his tonsils and adenoids taken out. And so that wouldn't necessarily be a chronic illness or disease. It's just a mishap of childhood. And so what happens to those children?
Ms. Mose, can you answer the question?
I can try, Madam Chair. And Representative Walker, there's no intent here to require a note in every case or a doctor's visit in every case. Certainly if there were, as Representative Fuller said, if it was below the 25 days or fewer than 10 consecutive, and it was a situation where there was a cold, there's absolutely no need, and I think we should make that clear for people to make trips to the doctor that are unnecessary. There's no need for an excused absence like you might expect at a school, and really no need for a visit to the doctor in those instances.
Madam Representative Walker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'd just say that with times being as hard as they are for counties, I understand the intent of this language, but it going in law and you having so many individuals needing child care assistance. And to me, it's just one way to make it more difficult for an individual to stay on with having such tight, restricted, documented language in this bill that may become law.
Representative Howell.
I know that there's a provision for counties to establish a more restrictive absent day policy. Is there a bottom for that? I mean, can they just say 0 days if they want?
Ms. Representative Fuller.
Madam Chair, Representative Dowell, there's nothing in this bill that sets a bottom, as you put it, that says, as far as I read the language, if they wanted to go zero, they could.
Well, Ms. Bowles.
Madam Chair and Representative Tell, the exception would be that any policy the county would adopt would have to reflect local market practices. So if the private pay people in the community are paying, you know, depending on what the absent day practice is locally, if it is the practice is to pay no absent days, then that would be acceptable. But if it's more than that locally, a county would not be able to do that per this provision, Madam Chair.
Is there anyone from the audience? I guess we have other members with questions. Representative Nornes first.
Madam Chair, just if I understand it right, right now the counties all can decide for themselves what that policy might be. There is no number, no days, and that's the purpose for this legislation. That's correct.
Ms. Moss.
Madam Chair and Representative Nornes, currently there are essentially no limits on the amount of absent days that the state can pay. And counties, as I understand it, really don't have the option to be to set their own policies in this regard.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair.
Representative Nornes.
I was just wondering if you've had any communication, either Representative Fuller or the counties, with the providers to see how they see this. Is this okay with those folks?
Ms. Moss.
Madam Chair and Representative Nornes, I think one of the reasons that the counties are bringing this bill forward, and maybe this may actually respond to Representative Walker's previous question more than yours, Representative Nornes, is that there are some concerns in counties about some of the impacts of some of the policy and fiscal changes from last year, some of which the counties frankly supported, particularly the fees to providers for licensing and so forth. And really the reason that we as counties wanted to bring this forward at this time was to try to balance the needs within the appropriation that's available between providers and recipients. The concern, the major concern among counties is that quite frankly, in counties where we haven't seen a waiting list in the past, we are seeing a waiting list. And although this certainly would impact providers, we view this as just a careful balancing of the resources that are available. And we, of course, if there were any savings that resulted from this policy change, would want to see those funds stay in the program and help fund the waiting list. I think I see one of the provider representatives has come to the table. We have discussed this with them, and I believe they're more comfortable with this than the original version of the bill. But perhaps, Madam Chair, it would be appropriate to
sure. Good morning. Good
morning, Madam Chair. My name is Ray Frost, for the record, with the Minnesota Child Care Association. And like I did last week when I testified on Representative Bradley's bill, which I believe this amendment pretty much puts it in line with Representative Bradley's bill we discussed last week. We are not, as I said last week, this is kind of a slippery slope. This is not something that we wanted to support, but we understand the intent. We understand why the counties are bringing it forward. We understand the troubles that they're having. But it's not something we're going to outwardly support because we believe, as Representative Walker said, this is kind of a slippery slope. One of the things in child care centers is the parent doesn't even have the ability to send their kid to a child care center if they have a cold. If a kid is in a child care center and has 101 fever, they have to go home. So the 10 consecutive days may not even be just in control of the parent, even though they say, well, my kid's better, I want them to go. The child care center has to send that kid home in preparation, not trying to get everyone else sick. I mean, these child care centers, unfortunately, as we all know, they're incubations for child sickness. So that's why we testified last week with Representative Bradley's bill saying it's reasonable, we understand the intent, but it's a slippery slope. So I'm happy to try and answer some questions that you might have with it.
Members, have any questions for Mr. Frost? Representative Otremba.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm still concerned about the documented, the medical, the need for some sort of documentation. If a county goes zero, which is a real possibility, then the parent has to get documentation from a doctor every time their child is sick. Is there a way to do that without having to make an appointment and pay the $20 or $30 or $40? Maybe they don't even have insurance. Is there a way to do that by an email from the nurse or something like that? Because that is a concern. If you drop it to zero, then they're always going to need a documentation from a medical person.
Ms. Mose.
Madam Chair and Representative Otremba, I don't think we've gotten to that level of specificity yet in deciding how this might be administered if it were to be passed into law, but I don't think there's any intent to create an undue hardship for a family. I think there's just a desire to document that something actually exists, just to be careful custodians of taxpayer dollars, and I don't think there's a need for undue rigidity in doing that as long as we, as counties, could receive some confirmation that a condition actually exists.
Madam Chair.
Representative Otremba.
But I think we need to know that. I mean, I need to know what that documentation entails. I live in an area where it's the highest uninsured rate in the state. And those people, I need to know that. Does it mean actually going to the doctor and having an appointment and getting a slip? Or can it mean an email or a phone call from a nurse? I need to know that before I'm okay with that. Especially when I know that counties have the option to go to zero.
Ms. Mose?
Madam Chair, part of the answer to this question might rely on what the commissioner would accept from counties as reasonable evidence that a documented medical condition existed. I don't know if you wanted to ask the department about that. Again, I don't know that these decisions have been made in terms of specifically how to administer the program at this point.
Well, first of all, I'll ask if there's anyone from the audience that wishes to testify to this bill. I don't see anybody really. But I have a couple other questions. Representative Dempsey had a question. Did you have one, Representative Dempsey?
Well, I'll pass for now, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Representative Samuelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to that point, most physicians or physician clinics, if your child is under their care, and they know that they have to be absent, will be able to issue a excuse or whatever you want to call it, and they can pretty much do that over the phone as long as that child's been under their care.
Representative Powell.
What if they don't have a physician?
Representative Samuelson.
Representative Bruno, is that question to me, Ms.?
Yeah.
Well, in that case, I think the people need to find a physician.
Perhaps that this is an issue that, you know, I'm not sure how it's being handled today. You know, if there are, you know, if there's any other area where there needs to be documented medical, you know, a documentation that's presented, obviously not. So this is kind of a new thing. I mean, obviously it could apply to education, K-12 education, or some other entity, but in regard to child care, I don't know if something's been established. So perhaps, and we had this discussion in an earlier bill, too, as to what that, how more specific it may need to be. So perhaps that's something that needs to be worked on as we move forward. I know this bill is being referred to finance. Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm willing to certainly work on that in finance. I wonder if we said something like, and I don't know if this is exactly the right kind of thing, but if we simply said something like from a licensed healthcare professional, which then opens it up to be a nurse or, I mean, a much broader, if that kind of thing would help you, Representative Otremba?
Representative Otremba.
That would help, but, you know, as Representative Samuelson said and Representative Towell, there are many of us. There are many people who do not even have a physician because they don't have any insurance. But maybe if you call the nurse or the UCare line or something like that, maybe
that
would
public
work.
Health or that kind of thing.
Exactly.
Representative Bradley, did you?
Well, Madam Chair, I mean,
suggestion at this point,
I guess if if it would help, at least as a placeholder for something, I'd be willing to offer an amendment on page 2, line 4, after medical needs, and staff can maybe see if I've got this right, to insert the words, from a licensed healthcare professional. I don't know if that's exactly the right place. Staff can help me with that.
Ms. Vanelli, would that be your area? Or is this Mr. Chun? I'm sorry.
Actually, Ms. Vanelli.
Ms. Vanelli.
Madam Chair and members, I think that for now that placement is okay.
Okay. Do members understand the amendment and where it's placed? And at this point, if we'll instruct research staff to make corrections if they're needed as we move forward. But I think it's pretty evident what the intent of the amendment is. Representative Bradley moves the amendment. Representative Tremba.
Madam Chair, could I ask the counties to, before the Finance Committee, what kind of documentation that they would be okay with? What would be the least thing that they would be okay with so that you had that ready for us for the Finance Committee?
Ms. Moles.
Madam Chair, we'd be more than happy to look into that. Again, as I stated, I think the purpose here is not to be rigid or unreasonable. It's just to put some reasonable limits on the program, so we'd be glad to do that.
Representative Dempsey.
Madam Chair, I just need a clarification. Are we talking about, I think we're talking about policy. I think we're talking about policy and not finance. Why can't we fix that here?
Well, Representative Dempsey, I think that's what we're going to do. That amendment is before us, so we're going to fix it here. I mean, maybe fix isn't the word. We're going to attempt to modify the language to make it more clear. But whether or not that's fixed,
Madam Chair.
Representative Dempsey, the amendment is before us.
Representative Otremba, does this meet your criteria that you would establish?
Representative Otremba.
Madam Chair, Representative Dempsey, I think this is a place holding, and that's what we've all agreed that this would be, and I'm okay with holding the place.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Representative Dempsey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Otremba, then you're satisfied with the policy statements that we have with the amendment, and that'll meet the needs that you you stressed?
Representative Otremba.
As for what we've agreed on, yes.
Okay.
All those in favor of the oral motion, Representative Bradley's motion, say aye.
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 Those opposed, motion prevails, and the amendment to the amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Since I'm not on finance, I would be interested, though, since you guys are going to be working on this bill going into finance, to figure out what the counties see as alternatives for individuals that don't have clinics, physicians, healthcare providers. Representative Antao and I were just saying, not everyone knows to call the public health nurse. Not everyone is okay doing that. They may be undocumented. They may have other issues that are going on, whatever their circumstances are, wanting to make sure that there aren't any individuals that fall through the cracks.
Any further discussion? And seeing no further discussion, I would renew the motion that House File 2473 be recommended to pass as amended and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Otremba, have you had a chance to look at either the minutes of the March 11th or March 10th meeting? Let's start with March 10th, the 37th meeting. Representative Otremba moves that adoption of the minutes of the March 10th, 2004 hearing. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes of the March 10th meeting are adopted. And Representative Paymar, would you be willing to move the minutes of the March 11th meeting?
Mm-hmm.
Representative Paymar moves minutes of March 11th meeting 2004. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. The next bill before us is Representative Representative Sandwichen, would you mind if we go to Representative Nornes first? I know we're changing and modifying the schedule, but would that be all right if we took up Representative Nornes's bill first?
That would be fine, Madam Chair.
And then we'll come to yours. You have two of them, and I would like to just get this one out of the way. Thank you. Representative Nornes, good morning.
Good morning. Madam Chair, I'd like to move House File 2885, and the motion would be to refer it to the Finance Committee.
Okay, the motion's before us. Please tell us about 2885.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 2885 clarifies for purposes of medical assistance coverage that public health nursing services include services provided by licensed home care agencies to children up to the age of 3 months. This bill addresses a problem. A policy change at the Department of Health and Human Services has disrupted the delivery of OB home health or home care services to moms and newborns on medical assistance. As of October 1st, newborns are covered under fee-for-service MA, and the moms are enrolled in PMAP. Prior to October 1st, both the moms and the newborns were enrolled immediately in the PMAP. An unintended consequence of this change has been that a licensed home care program offering only obstetrical services can no longer provide services to newborns. This has created an access problem in the metro area because public health agencies and other home care providers have not been able to pick up the additional volume. This bill would include a licensed home care agency that only provides obstetrical services as an eligible provider under medical assistance. Linda Sandvig is here from Alina Hospitals and Clinics and would like to further describe the need for this bill.
Good morning.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Linda Sandvig. I'm here with Alina Hospitals and Clinics, and we appreciate the opportunity that you squeezed this bill in on your busy schedule. As Representative Nornes had said, the background on this is that home care services have been provided as far as moms and babies. Abbott Northwestern provides OB home care services. Under the old system, under PMAP, we provided those services. We also provide services to all the Alina hospitals in the metro area, Buffalo, Shakopee area, and we also provide for Fairview and North Memorial services. As I was saying, under the old plan with PMAP, we were an eligible provider. We're licensed and we are JCHO accredited. However, under the fee for service, the qualifications under medical assistance are fairly specific, and that requires either that you're a public health agency or that you are Medicare certified. And obviously, since we only provide obstetrical services, we are not going to be Medicare certified. We have met with the department. We had hoped this would be an administrative change rather than a legislative, but because of the way that the law is structured for home care, we spoke with the department. There's been a disruption. We looked at October alone, about 240 families that we could not serve. We have tried to refer them to clinics and tried to refer to other public health hospital programs, and those are not getting picked up at this point. The department was supportive of fairly narrow crafting of language, and that's what's before you. And there appears to be that there would be a small fiscal note.
And thus why it's being referred to finance.
Right.
But Representative Nornes.
Madam Chair, that fiscal note is, our estimate is between $20,000 and $40,000. And we'll have something official to present to the Finance Committee when it comes before the committee.
Is there anyone from the audience that wishes to testify to this bill? Please come forward. Representative Bradley, did you have a question?
Wait,
you want to wait? Okay. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Patricia Colwell. I represent the Association of Minnesota Counties. I'm also speaking on behalf of the local public health association. We just briefly would like to support this bill because we think that it would allow services to be continued to be provided for moms and babies who are low income, and also help to prevent future health costs. So that's basically all I wanted to weigh in on.
Thank you. Thank you. Anyone else? Okay, Representative Bradley, you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make sure that I understood the testimony. Did I understand that the department supports this language and this policy?
Yes. Madam Chair, Representative Bradley, yes, they do. In fact, the language came from the department.
Thank you.
I saw a nod, Representative Bradley.
That works for me.
Okay, any discussion, members? Seeing no discussion, Representative Nornes renews his motion. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you. Now, Representative Samuelson. Representative Samuelson, where would you like to have state your motion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move to pass House File 2633 with recommendation to the General Register.
Okay, I believe it's 2637 to the General Register. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. We have the motion before us. Please tell us about the bill.
Yeah. This bill is the housekeeping technical bill for the Department of Human Services, and there are no financial implications or no changes to the context. I do have an author's amendment. I presume you have that in your...
Representative Samuelson moves the A04-1050 amendment.
Correct. Correct. Thank you.
All right.
And I do have Reggie Wagner here from the Legal Services Advocacy Project who will address the amendment.
Okay. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Reggie Wagner with the Legal Services Advocacy Project. The amendment before you are some policy clarification issues that we have discussed with the department that they're in support of and agree upon. There will be one change because of there's a provision included in here that shouldn't be, and I think Representative Samuelson will probably ask to have that stricken. There were a lot of policy changes last year within the MFIT program, and these are trying to just clarify some of the intent and provisions. A few places conform with federal law, and as I said, the department has reviewed these and is in support of them. And I can briefly just walk through the amendment if you would like.
I would just like to have the department, somebody... verify. Oh, Anne. Ms. Martineau, please.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, Anne Martineau from the Department of Human Services. We have reviewed this amendment and agree that it's purely technical and are perfectly fine.
Okay. Any more discussion on the amendment? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Madam Chair, I do have one correction in the amendment. On page 2, lines 8 through 10, need to be deleted. Okay. And I will move that.
Okay, so first of all, the amendment has not been adopted, so can we just strike those lines? We'll just strike on page 2, lines 8 through 10, and then the amendment, we'll vote on the amendment. Is that all the changes, Representative Samuelson?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay, all those in favor of adopting the 1050 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Representative Samuelson.
Okay. Accompanying me from the department are Ann Delvo, Lisa Nizan, Ann Martineau, and Shar Sadleck. And what I will do is go through the headlines or the basic articles, and then the people from the department can certainly answer any questions that may be here. Article 1 deals with child care and the Family Investment Program. It's a program to get people into jobs as soon as possible and does not count against the 60 months. It's actually a four-month program. And that article goes through the next page. Then Article 2 deals with long-term care. Article 3 deals with health care. And basically that's it. And these are just the technical adjustments therefore, if anybody has any question on these adjustments, the people from the department will answer them.
Representative Samuelson, has anyone expressed any concerns about this technical bill to you?
No, no, Madam Chair.
Is there anyone from the audience that wishes to testify to this bill? Are there any questions from members on this issue, this bill? Representative Powell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Samuelson, or representative from the department, I just need some clarification. On page 4, line 9, the subdivision 6B, we have a new language for allocation due to decreased funding. And I want, I'd like to have an explanation on this new language and the current law, which is another subdivision, but also talks about, and I'll just quote it, well, the current law says when the amount of funds available for allocation is less than the amount available in the previous year, each county's previous year allocation shall be reduced in proportion to the reduction in statewide funding. Now, I had a very difficult time deciding why we needed both, the new language and the old. If you could clarify that for me, I'd appreciate it.
Good morning, Ms. Kotelnik. Is this your area?
Good morning, Chairman Boudreau. Yes, this is my area. Could you please identify the two lines you're looking at again?
Representative Powell.
Certainly, Madam Chair. I'm looking at page 4, line 9, subdivision 6B, the new language that appears, allocation due to decreased funding. And I'm looking at that and comparing it to subdivision 8B that's in current law. And I'm wondering why we need both. And I'm sure there's a reasonable explanation.
Ms. Kotelnik.
Representative
Paul.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, subdivision 8B is already in current law and does not appear here in the bill.
Ms. Kotelnik.
Madam Chair, I don't have that piece in front of me, so it's going to be hard for me to talk about the relationship to them, but I can certainly talk to you about what's intended with subdivision 6B. And as we looked at the allocation reductions in fiscal year 03, we realized that there was no specific, there was intended direction, but there was no specific articulated statement about what to do when there was a significant allocation reduction and whether we needed to apply the funds, the reduction in a way that was different in each county or whether it was to be the same for each county. I believe the language in the other section talks about reductions in allocation that don't go below the base allocation. There's a 90% base. And so that would still allow us to apply the formula to allocation reductions. But in the case of last year, we didn't have enough money to apply the formula, and it happened in the middle of the year. So we needed to do a percentage across the board proportionate reduction for all counties, and this articulates the practice.
Any further questions? Representative Powell, do you have?
Well, I'm still struggling. I'm wondering if we're dinging the counties twice on this, is, I guess, my bottom line.
Madam Chair,
Ms. Kotelnik.
Madam Chair and Representative, we are not. We are truly not doing that.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Further discussion? Seeing no further discussion, Representative Samuelson renews her motion that House Bill 2637 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the General Register.
That's correct.
All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails. You know, these technical bills, members, they seem kind of mundane, but they take a lot of work, I can imagine, on behalf of the department. So thank you, department, for trying to make things easier. Representative Samuelson.
Okay, Madam Chair, I would like to move to pass House File 2246 with recommendation to the Health and Human Service Finance Committee.
Okay, Representative Samuelson, please present your bill.
Okay.
Do you have an amendment? A delete all amendment I see here.
Yes.
And that is DE1. Representative Samuelson moves the DE1 delete all amendment and to get the bill in the form she needs it. All those in favor of adopting the DE1 amendments, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair and members, this bill focuses on nursing home survey process and the quality care and services we must provide for our elderly and disabled. The issue basically, or issues, are respect, quality care and services, fairness, and common sense. The players are residents, family, staff, health department surveyors, and others. The concern is there has been some punitive and demoralizing nature of surveys in comparison with utilizing a collaborative approach to approve care and services for all customers, everyone that works or resides in nursing homes. An approach would be to provide legislative oversight, which is necessary to ensure the quality care without using adversarial and demeaning approaches during a survey. I'm all for measures to ensure quality care and services and nursing homes adhering to the standards set in regulations. That's why I've been working with the Long-Term Care Imperative, Elder Care Rights Alliance, Office of the Ombudsman, and others to find a better way. The bill before you is a start to move this process along to look at what can be done to address the issues. The Commissioner has started a kitchen cabinet to address these issues. What the bill does is provide for oversight and ask for reports so these efforts do not fail. The survey process is very important as a part of the total picture to ensure quality care and services for our elderly and disabled. Patty Cullen is here from Care Providers to review the elements of the bill.
Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Patty Cullen from Care Providers of Minnesota, representing the Long-Term Care Imperative today. The DE1 amendment is what I'll be working off of with talking points, and the DE1 amendment is a product of several meetings and discussions we have held with the consumer advocacy groups, and there may be a few technical issues with the DE1 amendment, but for the most part, we did hopefully address the vast majority of their concerns in this amendment and some subsequent amendments that I think that are going to be offered today. The DE1 amendment simply clarifies that training on new guidelines interpretations needs to be jointly provided to surveyors and providers at the same time. That has a twofold purpose. The first purpose is to make sure everyone is not surprised by new interpretations, so that if the surveyors are trained on, let's say, restraints, that was an issue commonly known to everyone in this committee, that the providers also receive that same training at the same time, so in the course of the next survey that they have, they're not surprised by it. The other reason for doing that is in other states that have instituted joint provider surveyor training, the evaluations and responses have been very positive. Positive in two fronts. It's an opportunity for the surveyors to get further training in some new technologies, new clinical standards that otherwise aren't part of their formal training process that comes down from CMS. The other point, at least in the Iowa joint training program that was identified in the evaluation, is it sets up a situation for more positive interactions between the surveyors and the providers. Because as you're familiar with, the only interaction that currently occurs is when the surveyor team walks in the door and the providers are in a panic mode. So the joint training should accomplish several things, and I don't believe there's much opposition to it. One of the comments by the department on this was a concern about the resource allocation with doing this. We are not saying that the health department has to actually pay for the training for all the providers, and actually in several of the states, the surveyors themselves, when they have training and they bring in clinical experts and other individuals to provide the training, the surveyors actually don't pay. The providers pay for the training and it covers costs for both. So this should not be a resource allocation issue for the first section. The second section essentially identifies the myriad of concerns and questions raised by providers, commissioner, a lot of the comments that were brought up at the hearing on the 25th, we've kind of encapsulated into what we believe is necessary to move us ahead in trying to get at the end goal of quality care for the older adults we serve. So the Quality Improvement Program and Annual Report establishes a variety of things that need to be looked at, and we call it a quality improvement program because in a quality improvement program you collect data, you analyze the data, and you determine if there are issues, how do you address them? And so we hopefully laid out some of the data that needs to be addressed here, including issues that we identified at the hearing before this committee, which was the cross-referencing that exists in our state that doesn't exist in other states, timelines for revisits, the scope and severity issue, those kind of things, and the consistency across the various regions of the state. So that's what Section 2 does. It identifies what should be done in this quality improvement program. Section 3 establishes some, or clarifies procedures with the survey process itself. All of these changes are within the federal guidelines. Most of these changes are already instituted by other states, and so we are just putting them in statute for our state to also follow it. Subdivision 1 clarifies that it's what survey process we're talking about. Subdivision 2 is very common in other states where they provide statements of deficiencies at the time of the exit, the draft statements, and provide them with completed statements within 10 calendar days. This happens. The health department has tried to comply with this actually right now, but it's not consistently applied. In some districts and some surveys it does happen, in others it doesn't, so we are just clarifying that it needs to be done consistently for all surveys. Surveyor notes, I know there's some concerns about this particular provision, and hopefully a subsequent amendment will take care of those concerns. This is the issue. In the course of the survey process, there are actually what's called surveyor notes documented on a formal form that's part of all the survey forms, that where the surveyor jots down their observations, what they see, and kind of the justification for the citations that are going to be issued against the facilities. In other states, it's commonplace for, in some other states, for the surveyor notes to actually be available upon request to the provider so they can determine whether or not they need to appeal. Sometimes in the course of reading the formal statement of deficiencies, a provider doesn't really know if they should be appealing or not. And in this case, the surveyor notes will help them determine who they were talking about, what the circumstances were, what they were observing, and in some cases they can make a decision at that point, should they appeal or not appeal. And we're hoping that this will end up minimizing what some have called frivolous appeals, and at the same time help the providers in their decision-making process when they receive their completed statements of deficiencies. The other point on here is we did give a choice, you know, either at the time of the exit givet or when the completed statement of deficiency is provided, and I believe that there's going to be an amendment that deletes that choice, and that's totally fine. Subdivision 4, posting statement of deficiencies. One of the reasons we put this language in the way we did here is because we wanted to be consistent with what the Medicare Compare federal process is. The federal process for posting the statement of deficiencies, it states in the instruction sheet in the cover that they will not post the specific citations if they are under dispute. If the facility is going through the dispute resolution process, they won't post them. This is also a subject of concern on the part of, I think, consumers as well as the state agency. Our rationale was saying you need to wait, make sure that the deficiencies that are up there are accurate, both from the surveyor perspective and the provider perspective, as it's consumer information, and we want to make sure they have the correct information. So I think you will hear a little bit more on this later, but the rationale for us doing it that way was because we wanted to be consistent with the Medicare Compare postings and how they do that. Subdivision 5 on survey revisits. I believe this is a subdivision that will send this to Representative Bradley's committee. Right now, the survey revisits are conducted not necessarily as quickly as we would like in all situations. It's a scheduling issue with the surveyors in terms of who's available at what point in time when they schedule them. The problem we have is that it's really a financial burden for us when they decide that revisits are not a priority. When Category 2 or Category 3 remedies are in place, which are identified in Subdivision 5, this means there are either daily fines or there are no payment for new admissions occurring on a daily basis. So facilities have thousands of dollars of penalties existing, even if we've come into compliance and we've called them, we're waiting for the resurvey, and they can't get the scheduling to work so that they come back. So each day they don't come back for a revisit has a financial cost to our facilities. That's why we want to kind of put in here something, some framework that we can use so that we can ensure they'll come back. And some of the discussions have been, well, maybe we just need to make sure it's a priority. Well, we don't understand what priority means when each day is a significant financial burden. We're a little bit concerned that the word priority isn't going to give us the comfort that we need, that you're going to be back within a period of time. The other part of this is in other states, they don't revisit for everything. They do resource allocation in this area of revisits. In many other states, they have, if the deficiencies are not of a high scope and severity, meaning they're not very serious, they'll just do a telephone revisit and ask for certain information to be sent, and that's how you handle it. So I'm hoping that somehow Subdivision 5 will eventually balance itself out fiscally so that if they can do phone revisits, it takes away from the scheduling part in the first sentence of that subdivision. Section 4 just clarifies that the Department of Human Services is the state Medicaid agency that contracts with health to conduct surveys, and it kind of puts them in the loop a little bit on these discussions and the reports and studies that have happened. And then Section 5 is a separate report that's a one-time report that looks at the three different laws that you passed in the course of the last few years that actually haven't been implemented. And in particular, the first one was the defensive documentation. You hear from the nursing facility nurses about the large number of hours that are spent just doing documentation that something has or has not been done. Defensive documentation is a term where you only document when something different happens. You don't have to continue to document when it's no change is made. And so that was an area that we had a study several years ago, 2000, 1999, something like that. We met once and then it stopped. And so we'd like to go back and take a look at that issue. Last session, the provider work group was established to take a look at some of the state regulations. That was the result of some discussion and concern by the consumer groups that we don't just want to get rid of state regulations. We want to take a look at duplicative. And the work group hasn't started, so we want to make sure there's a progress report on that. And then the independent informal dispute resolution process, which was also passed last year and scheduled to be going into effect either July or August 1st, still has not been implemented. And this is the process where if you have a dispute, instead of going to the health department, there's a independent administrative law judge that looks at that, and that still has not been implemented. Section 6 is actually a federal waiver request section, and one of them was in a bill last year that passed the floor and was included in the omnibus bill signed into law, which was taking a look at the what we call the double G issue, and that's the subclause B, to make sure that if it's possible, our region, there's nothing in federal regulation that requires the double G process, meaning if you get two G-level citations, different types of penalties occur. And so the Commissioner of Health had agreed to go forward and take a look at this, and we're just repeating that language here. Subclause A was also part of legislation several years ago, taking a look at the alternative survey process, which would stagger surveys. So this would focus the resources on the nursing home surveys where they need greater oversight. There are some nursing facilities that do need greater oversight than others, and it would allow our state, instead of following the you must be surveyed within 15 months, it would allow, with an average of 12 months, allow them to have a little more flexibility in the scheduling. And so that is a waiver request that we are asking to be repeated at this point in time. So that is kind of a long-winded summary of the various provisions of the bill. And I would stand for any questions.
Any questions for Ms. Cullen or Representative Samuelson? Representative Nornes.
I don't have a question, really, just a comment. That last section where you talked about the waiver, I think that's an excellent idea. I've felt for a long time, well, and talked to administrators, too, that have felt that if they're doing a good job of running their home, that they should have a little bit of a break. You know, there should be a reward there somewhere. So, thank you.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Although it's not part of a proposal, but I'm wondering if you can tell me what the status of the alternative dispute resolution that we have passed in the past, that where we are with that.
Ms. Cullen.
Well, we had worked on the bulletin during the summer, and the health department has given several dates where it was going to be released, and the last date we were assured was Wednesday 2 days ago, and we were just informed this morning that wasn't going to be. It didn't happen on Wednesday, and there was going to be further meetings to discuss it.
Representative Bradley.
Madam Chair, I know it's not directly in this bill, but if we pass laws and they don't happen, then we're wasting our time here. And so I'd like to have the department come down and tell us about that, because it is one of the things. It's a reform that I think is sort of related to this. So I'd like to know where we are in that.
See Mr. Triple here. Would you like to come down, Mike? Good morning. Perhaps you can give us an update on the dispute resolution issue.
Madam Chair, my name is Mike Triple. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Health. As Ms. Cullen did indicate, a number of the providers and their attorneys worked on pulling a prototype draft together. It has been reviewed. We sent it out for comments for other individuals, the advocates, other concerns, staff concerns. It has been a issue that I have not been able to complete with a lot of the other activities. We've pulled together the comments that have come in from the various stakeholders. As Ms. Cullen indicated, we had hoped to get that draft out this week for further comments. We are scheduling a meeting with attorneys and others to kind of work through the comments, because there is a pretty significant disparity between the approaches in that informal process. But some of the other events during the course of the summer created some other priorities.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Triple, I guess this would just be a comment. You certainly saw the frustration and the long testimonies that we had, and I thought that the alternative dispute resolution was an important tool in trying to do something about that, and I'm really disappointed how slow that's moved along. And now we have what I think are a number of really good proposals before us again to try to turn the crank and to make this a more effective approach, the whole business of doing surveys. But if we pass laws and then there's just, it takes forever to do them, then we're really struggling. I hope that we move things a lot faster. The frustration level is getting so great amongst our constituents that we have to see these kinds of things turn into implementation. And I just hope that the alternative dispute resolution will be implemented very, very soon. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Triple.
Madam Chair, Representative Bradley, I would agree with that, and I think over the course of the summer, a number of the things that are, have been identified in the bill have, in fact, been implemented. Representative Samuelson talked about the kitchen cabinet. We have a number of work groups, so we had kind of different things that we were getting done in terms of trying to deal with some of those other issues. So a lot of the things in this quality improvement plan, through the work group that is focusing on some of the data discrepancies, we have a work group that is focusing on the communication process and the surveys intended to really address concerns, focusing from the adversarial process to a number of other things. Those things have been in place. I believe the commissioner indicated that we also have group from the management analysis division from the Department of Administration actually spending time and starting to interview lots of stakeholders to look at the management structure within the organization. So a lot of those activities have been started through the course of the summer, and so many of the things that are in the bill, and I certainly understand the reason for putting them in the bill, have in fact been started and are aggressively moving forward.
So Mr. Triple, are you saying that this would be a priority for the department to get that?
I think the IDR, I think continuing with the work groups, those are both significant priorities for the department, Madam Chair.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess to put something more specific, Mr. Triple, when will we implement the alternative dispute resolution?
Mr. Triple.
Madam Chair, Representative Bradley, I would hope that we would be able to do it, that first week in April.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe just as a concluding, my frustration level with how things get delayed and so forth is high enough. I'm tempted, as we start doing these things, to start having stronger language in terms of deadlines and consequences of missing deadlines. I hope we don't have to come to that, but we just can't have important initiatives that are really important problem solvers. We can't afford to have them being jawbone forever.
Okay, any Representative Tremba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Madam Chair, I actually would echo Representative Bradley's opinions. I think it's time that we do put dates in. And actually, I'm disappointed because I'm actually hearing from some of the people, not only in my district but around, but that there has been some retaliation of people testifying. And so I've really about just about had it. And I think we need to put some dates in, and so it gets done and we get moving on this, because I think we're beyond our limit.
Well, we certainly heard the testimony, members. There's some things we can do that, you know, don't necessarily take a lot of finance dollars, and this is one of them. This is one of them. Members, I think at this point we have some amendments, and Representative Paymer, perhaps we should go to those.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have five amendments.
Which one would you like to start with?
I'd like to do, there's two of them that deal with subdivision 3 under surveyor's notes, the A1 and the A5, so I think I'd like to do the A1 amendment, and I've discussed these amendments with Representative Samuelson, and I think she's, well, I'll let her speak, but I think we're in agreement on some of the amendments. And
that's correct.
Representative Paymer moves the A1 amendment, and perhaps
this is the,
you could describe.
Okay. What I'm doing here, this is the language that requires the Health Department to hand over the surveyor's notes to facilities. Requiring the surveyors to give the nursing home these notes at the exit conference. What I'm doing is simply deleting after, on line 21, after the word forms at the time of the exit conference. So this just deletes that provision.
Okay. Any discussion? Representative Samuelson.
Madam Chair, we did feel that amendment is okay, that's very workable.
Okay. Any discussion? All those in favor of adopting the A1 amendment, say aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Paymer.
Madam Chair, then the next one is the A5. We're a little out of order here in your packet, but the A5 also deals with subdivision 2.
Representative Paymer moves the A5 amendment.
So this is the... This adds language requiring a written consent of the individual subject who was interviewed by the surveyor before the notes may be shared with the facility. So it's fairly straightforward that they have that written consent. So that would be a family member of the resident at the facility, or the staff member who was interviewed by the surveyor. And it's just some added protection for those individuals who are providing that information to the surveyor. I think there's been some concern about whether someone would give information or fear of retribution or something, and this is just, I think, provides some comfort to those people who are providing the information.
So, Representative Paymer, would this apply then to the residents of the homes?
Yes.
And all of the staff,
yes,
as well?
Yes.
And family members?
Madam
Representative Samuelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In lieu of this amendment, we were looking at different language. So on page 3, line 21, after of, we would want to insert the resident family and staff interviews, and then delete the rest of that line and the first two words on line 22. We felt that in looking at this, and I think Patty can probably address it too, in looking at this, that this does provide the security that is needed or the confidentiality that is needed for the residents.
There is an amendment before us, and at this point, you know, you either have to modify this amendment, or I think I'd suggest a discussion.
I'm not sure what you're doing that's different, Representative Samuelson.
I'm going to defer that to
Ms. Cullen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Paymer, we're trying to get at the same thing that you're trying to get at with this language. Unfortunately, in talking to some of the consumer groups on this amendment, this could be read that if any individual is mentioned in the surveyor notes, you know, I observed residents XYZ in the surveyor notes, that the surveyors would then have to take all this time to ask every person who's mentioned in the surveyor notes. Because your amendment doesn't refer to interviews. It says anyone who's the subject of the survey note. So I observed so-and-so walking. I observed so-and-so not getting fed. Every resident who's mentioned, not interviewed, just mentioned in the survey notes, you'd have to go back at. So we thought that our language would clarify that you mean the interviews, not the subject of, because all the surveyor notes contain all of the observations. And residents who don't even know they're being observed are in the surveyor notes. Now, we also have protection for the resident because we redact the information, which is also in here, so their name is not mentioned in the surveyor notes. Their name is blocked out. And I believe, I think I talked to Ms. Kelso before this, and she was okay with the language that Representative Samuelson noted as taking care of the issue.
Okay. So, I guess...
Representative Paymer, would you to modify your amendment, or would you like to withdraw it and maybe...
I would be fine with that. I would just accept Representative Samuelson's language.
Okay. Representative Powell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if I heard Representative Samuelson's amendment correctly, she was amending... Oh.
First of all, let's Representative Paymer will withdraw the A5 amendment so we can deal with the issue in a different manner. So, Representative Powell, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I heard Representative Samuelson's amendment correctly, she was amending language that was deleted by the A1.
No. Let's, Ms. Cullen, could you repeat the proposed change?
On page 3, line 21, after of, insert, the resident, family, and staff, and then at the end of the word interview, add an S and delete the word forms.
Okay, members, does everyone understand that? It would say, with the exception of the resident, family, and staff interviews. Period. Is there, okay. I see some nodding, Representative Paymer, over there.
Madam Chair, I just want to make sure that they're all on board with that. Okay. That's a go.
Nodding works today, doesn't it? Good. Okay. So the amendment is before us. All those in favor of adopting the amendment as stated by Representative Samuelson, say aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Then, Madam Chair, the A2 amendment deals with a section or subdivision 4. And this is the one that deals with the posting issue. This is the posting information relative to deficiencies. So what I'm doing here is deleting this section on line 32 that prohibits the posting of deficiencies. And that's it. This is just important for consumers that they should be able to look up on the website and find out if there's what deficiencies have been identified at a nursing home. It's consumer information that everyone should have, that every family should have to know what is going on in a particular nursing home. This can be obviously, as you know, a difficult time for families, and there's a lot of choices that families have to examine when they're a loved one is being put in a nursing home, and they should have all the information, I believe, at their disposal. So this bill would really, or this language that's currently in the bill would hamper that ability, and the amendment takes that language out.
Okay, so Representative Paymer, moving the A2 amendment, it would then not be able to have the corrected deficiency or the response. It would, that would not be on the website. You were talking about having information. Some of it would not obviously be on there initially. But let's have Representative Samuelson respond.
Madam Chair, I guess the one question that I have here is if there is an issue with the federal language and the state language being different. And I don't know if someone can answer that.
Is there anyone from the either research or department that would have knowledge of that? Ms. Cullen, do you know that? Oh, well. Ms. Cullen.
Madam Chair, committee members, as I said in the description of the bill, the Medicare Compare website, if a citation is under the dispute resolution process, it is not posted. And one of the reasons is their system doesn't allow them to do that. In talking to Jerry Sandlin from CMS yesterday or the day before, they do not include them if it's being disputed. Now, you know, it's other states do it different ways. They do. I mean, I know that if you've all looked at the recent postings on the website, there's a cover sheet that they have put together now along with everything else. The only issue before this committee is they're going to have, if they look at the same facility, you're going to have two different pieces of information on there. If you click onto the federal Medicare Compare, you will not have the citations with the specific examples listed if the facility is going through a dispute resolution. If you click on ours, it will be up there, and somewhere in all the papers there will be a cover sheet that says they're disputing that. So, again, for consumer information purposes, I guess it's up to the committee if you're okay with a little bit of confusion there. If you want to be consistent with the federal Medicare Compare process, I guess you probably wouldn't accept the amendment, but it's your choice.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Kramer, I thought toward the end of your introduction of your amendment, speaking for it, you actually spoke for voting against it because you said about making sure that people get all the information. And it looks to me like what your amendment does is removes the possibility of getting all the information. Because it doesn't say we can't post it. What it says is that you shouldn't post it until you have the balance of all the information. And, of course, the fact on the dispute resolution that it would be premature to post it until that's been done. So if you really want all information, then we should leave the language like it is.
Madam Chair, Representative Bradley, as I understand it, if there is a deficiency that's on appeal, then all of the deficiencies are not posted until that appeal is satisfied. I think, Madam Chair, it would be appropriate, I would ask that if it would be okay to hear from someone from the elder care groups that have the most concern about this information.
Absolutely.
Since we've heard from Ms. Cullen.
Whoever would like to speak.
Or
the department.
Or from ARP or whoever.
Does the department want to weigh in as well? Okay. Please. Let's have the department first. Because maybe there's some clarification that could be made and resolve some of our questions. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Carol Wolverton. I'm the Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Health. And just a little bit of clarification on the current website that we do have up and running right now and where we are listing the 2567s and in conjunction with the federal Compare. Compare currently just lists the tag. It doesn't give any of the narratives. And, yes, it does not put it up there until IDRs or appeals have been put through. What we have done at the department, because all of this information is public information, when you have an IDR or an appeal in process, the very first page that comes up on the website, and I have a copy of it here, lists that there is an IDR or an appeal in process, and it lists the tags of the 2567 that are being refuted. And then we list the entire 2567, not only listing the tags, but the narrative that goes with those tags. This is public information. If any consumer wanted to come to the department and ask for this information, they could. So we do put it up on the website, and that's how it is currently on the website right now.
Okay. Very good. So you're already, Ms. Wolverton, you're already doing this.
That's correct.
Any questions for Ms. Wolverton? Representative Bradley.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure that it's the same as what this is, though. You post it with a notice on it. This would say don't post it until it's been resolved.
It doesn't,
Ms. Wolverton.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Bradley, yes. This would say not to post it until it is resolved. However, that is public information, so if any consumer called the agency and asked for that information, we would have to provide it to them. So it is already public information.
Okay. Seeing no further questions, thank you for clarifying that. And good morning. Please come up and state your concerns.
Madam Chair, I'm Amy McDonough, and I'm representing AARP, and we have a volunteer here, Karna Brewer, who can speak to, and you have a copy of her entire testimony. I think the important thing for us is that we support what the health department is currently doing, putting a notice up on the website that says it's under dispute, but still providing access to that disputed deficiency. We think it's important for consumers to have that full access to information. Even if the Medicare website is a little bit different, we still feel like consumers are going to go to both places to get that information. And so we would support the PAMAR amendment and urge the committee to adopt that. And you can hear Karna's complete testimony if you want to, and you have a copy of that. It's really up to you.
Perhaps she could just introduce herself. We'll just do this. I think this is sufficient, but just state your name.
Madam Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Karna Brewer from Anoka, Minnesota. I'm sorry that our representative isn't here today, but he said that he would miss this committee today, Representative Abler, who serves on this committee.
Sure.
You indicated you didn't want to hear any testimony.
Ms. Brewer, I think we'll just accept your written testimony as sufficient, unless members would like to hear more, but I think we have an understanding of what the position is. Unless you have something to add other than what was mentioned.
I wondered if I could relate an incident to the committee related to posting of information.
Absolutely.
I serve as a volunteer at the nursing home in Anoka, one of the nursing homes in Anoka. And as a volunteer, I work there with the residents, actually just assist them in playing bingo. But sometimes they call on me to do other things, like produce adult bibs for the eating problems and other commode covers and things like that. And so I'm in the facility in an informal way a lot. And one time I happened to see an announcement in public view of a survey that had existed against this facility. Now, if you had just simply posted that there was action being taken place, someone might think something had happened there that was an indication of lack of care. I was happy to be able to read the document myself and noticed that what had happened was basically a result of lack of communication between the members of the staff. It was an incident in which an individual was, in the end, injured, but not because of staff neglect. The individual fell and hit his head and needed stitches as a result of an infection, which was not detected because the test material was misplaced. And when the people came to collect that material, it wasn't available to take to the hospital for analysis for an infection. In the meantime, the staff thought the material had gone because there had been a shift in the staff. So it was some time before people realized this individual was, in fact, getting worse, that their behavior was more erratic, that they lost, that this individual lost their balance and fell and hurt themselves. But it wasn't the facility itself that neglected this person. They did the, they took the material, they had it waiting for people to pick it up. The people, they notified the people it was ready. They came and got to get the material. But because of the shift in the staff, they didn't know where the sample was. And the man had to wait longer before he got the care he needed. This was, it was important to me to know that as a result of this survey, that the staff now had to present to the state a plan of how they would correct and improve the communication between the nursing staff shifts, one to the other, and things that were expected of the staff from one shift to the other, and communicating to those who came on the next time that certain things hadn't happened. Without that in place, I was pleased to think that the state was there to provide the facility with a chance to correct a problem that at another time might not lead to injury to a resident.
Thank you, Ms. Brewer. Appreciate that. To the A2 amendment, any more discussion? Representative Paymar?
Madam Chair, I think if I understood the department correct, that they basically said the same thing that I said and about the fact that that the provider wouldn't have to post deficiencies until the dispute was resolved by appeal. So that would mean that you could have a minor deficiency, and while that appeal process was going on, which could take several months, as I understand, and I don't pretend to be an expert on nursing homes by any means, but if the appeal took several months, that would mean that all of the other deficiencies would not be posted. And I think this is a major problem for consumers. I think I've been convinced about the seriousness of this sufficiently enough that I'd like to ask for a roll call, because I really do think this is a consumer issue.
Sure. Ms. Cullen, did you have a response?
Madam Chair, it's my understanding. It's my understanding that they are posted. Are we looking at websites here?
Websites. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The facility does post in the facility the deficiencies, and someone from the department can come back. I was under the impression that it was also posted on the website.
Ms. Cullen.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, perhaps, I'm just suggesting this, our intention is not that we wouldn't post the citations if there's anything under appeal or anything being disputed. That wasn't our intention. Our intention was the particular tag, you know, F-286, that's being disputed. Just as the federal site doesn't post just the particular tag, it posts the whole statement of deficiencies minus the ones that are being disputed. So if the question is the language here, if it needs to be clarified to say, page 3, line 33, to say that the commissioner is prohibited from posting tags from the statement of deficiency. So we don't want you to not post it. We just don't want you to post the particular items that are under dispute. So I don't, in response to what you're saying, maybe that would help mitigate it. We don't want it absent. We certainly want a statement up there, and if something's under dispute, that's the only item we don't want on there.
Representative Nornes.
Madam Chair, I have just a question maybe the department can answer, and it's just kind of a curiosity. My father is in a nursing home, and so is my mother-in-law, and I've never, ever thought of going to a website to check on his nursing home. My question is, I assume there's a way to determine how many hits they get. Is this a very popular place for people to inquire? And I mean, we're spending a lot of time on the issue. I'm just wondering how the consumers are actually active. actively searching for that information.
Madam Chair.
Representative Samuelson.
It's my understanding that Monday was the date that the federal government just started posting. That the state did. I'm sorry.
Oh. Well, then the answer probably would be rather small at this point.
Ms. Wolverton, would you like to weigh in on this?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. In reference to hits on the website, I just happen to have what that piece of information is. When the website went up on March 1st and through the first 6 days, there were 5,067 hits to the main survey page. There were 4,111 queries to that. The hits to the survey output were 3,924 hits. And the number of actual PDF files that were downloaded from that website, 7,817 in 1 week.
Thank you very much.
That's pretty remarkable for only 11 days.
Six days.
Oh, 6 days.
6 days.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. Representative Bradley.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I think there's an idea being floated, and I'd like to hear Mr. Reaction.
Representative Paymar, the idea that was floated by Ms. Cullen.
Madam Chair, I would ask if Kathleen Kelso maybe could. I want to make sure that if there's a way to work this out, I'd like to do it. I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on this, but I think there's still concerns about the suggested language by Ms. Cullen.
Madam Chair.
Representative Samuelson.
One more reiteration or point from our health department first.
Yes, please. Wolverton. Any suggestions?
Madam Chair and Representative Samuelson has asked if all of the deficiencies are posted on the website, even if they are in dispute. And that answer is correct. All deficiencies are posted. But again, like I said, there is a cover page, and I do have copies of these, and I can leave these if the committee would like to see what the actual cover page is. It actually reads that the facility has requested informal dispute resolution or has appealed tags identified below. Once the survey findings will be updated based on the final IDR and appeal determination, and then it lists the actual tags that are in dispute. We print the entire 2567. We just don't list tags and give a title. We do the entire 2567, which is the list of deficiencies on the website. That is public information.
Is it possible for Ms. Kelso and Ms. Cullen to just have a brief discussion about on their own? Have a brief discussion about this issue and good morning.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kathleen Kelso. I'm the Executive Director of the Elder Care Rights Alliance. Our main concern with the language specifically that states that the commissioner is prohibited from posting a statement of deficiency is that currently as it is now, we believe this language would actually take away from the website public information. And although the federal language states that it is public information, even the federal language states that deficiencies that are currently being reviewed under informal dispute would not be posted. We're suggesting that we keep the Minnesota practice as it is, as it's currently on the website, and that all deficiencies, all tags, be public information and remain public information. The law, the federal law, states that it's all public information and we want to keep it that way. Policy may be on the federal website that the disputed ones are not up on the website, but we're maintaining that everything should be fully disclosed. So in the interest of public disclosure, we would like to take that entire sentence out.
Ms. Kelso, in looking at that statement, it sounds like the first part of do you have it before you?
Yes.
Page 3, line 32, the commissioner is prohibited from posting a statement of deficiency if the facility's response is not included. Right. Do you have any opposition to that?
The same sentence,
Ms. Kelso,
as I read it, the same sentence is established at the very beginning of that subdivision that states, the commissioner, when posting statements of a nursing facility's deficiencies on a website, must include the posting, the facility's response to the citation. So for me, as I read it, and maybe I'm wrong, that first sentence reads the same way as the first half of the sentence under dispute. So to me, that's redundant as it stands. It's the second part, or if appeals or informal dispute resolutions by the facility have not been settled, seems to be an all-encompassing statement. If there's one dispute, none of the deficiencies are cited or are made public information.
Okay, Ms. Kelso, it seems as though what the bill language is asking for is that recognizing that there has been an unsettled informal dispute resolution be also included. It seems as though that's what is the additional thing that's being asked for. Do you have any opposition to that being included in the response?
I think that if we could get this particular language written so that all deficiencies are made public on the website, and they continue to be on the website as we have it today, then I'd be fine. But it appears as if the preference is to go with the federal practice, which is to not put on the website those that are under dispute. And
I'm not sure we're going to have an agreement on this, members. But I think this is going to take a little more discussion. You know, perhaps it would be appropriate to, I'm not really opposed to the PMAR amendment, as long as there's a willing to work out something to get some language that might be agreeable.
I'm perfectly willing to work on language.
Maybe that could be done. Representative Bradley, it's going to your committee. Is that something you can handle? Representative Bradley.
Well, yeah, I think so. I do think there's some confusion. I think you had a good question, but I think there's confusion in response to the question.
And it's too hard to figure this one out right here. I mean, I've got other committees and everybody else does too. And,
perhaps in summary, I just might say that the intent, whatever the intent is of this language, it's not clear in the statement as it stands in this delete everything amendment. And we're hoping that Representative Paymar's amendment would be accepted to take out this particular sentence because it leads to so much broad interpretation, it seems to us. We want the Minnesota practice to stand.
Ms. Kelso, I'd be willing to support the PMAR amendment if you'd be willing to work with Ms. Cullen to at least be attentive to their needs of having some mention of the independent or the dispute resolution process being mentioned or included in that information.
Certainly.
Ms. Kelso?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank
members,
you.
Can we do that? Representative Bradley?
Well, Madam Chair, I'd prefer actually the opposite. That is that we not adopt it, because then we at least have language. Otherwise, we do it, the language is gone, and you have no mechanism until you recreate it. Now, I realize, but otherwise, it's not even in here for purposes of refinement.
Well, Representative Bradley, I understand your concern, but I think, as I mentioned, the bill's coming to your committee. If it isn't satisfactory language, we can rework it, but Ms. Kelso has just committed to trying to work with Ms. Cullen to find a solution that is acceptable to both. And I think it's doable. And I think, Representative Paymar, that's what you want, isn't it?
Absolutely, Madam Chair.
Okay.
And if there's concurrence with the committee, I'd withdraw my request for a roll call.
That's fine. Sure. Okay. Committee, can we do this? All those in favor of adopting the A2 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails. Okay. And Representative Paymar, which amendment are you on next?
The A3 amendment is on page 4, subdivision.
Representative Paymar moves the A4 amendment.
Subdivision 5, and this is the issue about the revisits within a 10-day time frame. And so this language on page, on line one, deletes after conduct, just inserts the words give highest priority to, and then deletes the following language. So it essentially takes out that 10-day requirement. And I believe Representative Samuelson is okay with
Madam Chair.
Representative Samuelson.
No, I think with this one we need a fiscal note because of the surveyors having to resurvey. But I think the other issue with this one is this is the point when the facilities are probably under daily fines and someone needs to be out and recheck the facility as fast as possible to ensure that they're in compliance. Otherwise, this, from a monetary standpoint, this can be very severe for the facilities. And so I guess I would recommend that we just continue to work on this and hold it for the Finance Committee.
Just further discussion, Representative Pimar.
Ms. Kelso, are you all right with okay. Are you suggesting we not offer this amendment?
All Representative right. Pimar, you can bring it to Finance if you want.
Okay, I'll withdraw the A3 amendment.
Okay. The A4 amendment. Representative Pimar moves the A4 amendment.
Madam Chair, the final amendment is right at on page 8. We're adding a new subdivision, a subdivision 6. That would state that nursing facility family council shall be interviewed as part of the survey process and invited to participate in the exit conference.
And Representative Samuelson, any feedback on that one?
Madam Chair, Representative Pavement, this one's just fine. In fact, I encourage it.
Representative Pamer, when I read this, I just wondered if, you know, not to be nitpicky, but does this mean the entire council, or does this mean a representative from the council, or does that need to be clarified? I didn't know, because does this mean that you have to meet with the whole council, and you know how that is?
Madam Chair.
Representative Samuelson.
Generally, the surveyors either post that there's going to be a meeting of the family council or request people to get the information to them, and as many people as can come would come.
Okay, so this is not a problem. All right, good. Any further discussion? All those in favor of the A4 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. Members, any further discussion on this bill? And I look forward to having some of these little issues resolved when it comes back to Finance, and those of us who are on Finance. And Representative Samuelson will renew her motion that House File 2246 be recommended to pass, be re-referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. Members, we have completed or at least reached the deadline we were asked to reach this week. And I know there were hundreds of bills that was referred to this committee. I just want to thank you for your indulgence. And I'm not going to say it's entirely done, because we have some. Next week will be the Senate files. So far, we have not received too many, but they could be coming today. We have reserved Monday at 12:30 for committee time. Right now, we don't have any bills, so I just want you to know that we have to be prepared should we have some. So with that, committee is adjourned.